make long story short, when I was over in Europe and we had dealt with some of these, I came back from this trip where the big Canaanite altar had been done, and I just had been gone for 3 months. That whole trip was a 3 month ordeal, and I was ready to make a beeline home and take some rest. And my wife and children had been over with me for part of it. They had come back to Oklahoma, and I was missing my family. I just wanted to get off the plane, and I had a car in New York because my brother lives there, and we had drove out there to visit with him and some friends. And I just wanted to make a beeline home in my car and not stop for anything but gas. When I landed in New York, the Holy Spirit said to me, I know you want to get home. I know you're missing your family. But I need you to do one more thing before you go. And he said, the timing is important. Before you go back to Oklahoma, go down to Jekyll Island, Georgia.
Jekyll Island.
And I said, Lord, I don't even know. You know, I knew something about Jekyll Island. I had looked at some of the financial issues in the 80s and 90s. I was looking at some of the spiritual applications to financial things, but I really was not up to speed on the history of Jekyll Island. I had just heard it from something. I'd not even read, you know, the book that's called The Creature of Jekyll Island. I'd not even read that book, but I was aware of something about Jekyll Island and financial stuff. So I went in my brother's house, got my computer out, and I just, you know, got on the internet and typed in Jekyll Island. And it's like, what's going on with Jekyll Island? And was praying and asking the Lord, why do I need to go there? And he said, when you get there, I will explain to you why, what you need to do. But he said, he just told me, he says, go to the island and plan to spend, it's not that far from New York, but he said, I need you to tarry for a day or two and listen to me. I'll tell you what to do. So I discovered when I got online that the Jekyll Island Club, which was this historical, you know, multi-millionaires country club that had been built in the turn of the century, it had just been remodeled and reopened. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. And immediately the Spirit of the Lord said, that's where I want you. Book a room there. And so I just booked me a room for that night and got in the car and headed that way. All the way down there, I'm driving and I'm praying. And I don't like, I know when the Lord tells me to do something like that, I have to obey. At the same time, I'm one of these guys that I don't like doing anything alone. I don't think God sends people alone. I think he often wants us to go in twos or threes.
Right.
And I'm not afraid to go alone, but it's just like, Lord, where's my little buddy Leahu? Where's my, you know, there's got to be something important or God would not be diverting me. And I don't know anybody in Jekyll Island, you know, so I'm thinking, who do I know in Georgia that I can call? Maybe there's somebody that can come over and join me. And I just was complaining a little bit. It's like, Lord, I'm tired. I've been gone for a long time. I'd really rather be going home. What's so important about Jekyll Island that I got to go there now? And the Lord just encouraged me. He's like, son, please don't complain. I don't ask you to do something unless it's important. I'm directing your steps, and this must be done now. So I quit complaining and grumbling, and I just started praying and cheering up. And so I tried to just pray in the Spirit all the way down there. When I got to the hotel, it was about 9 o'clock at night. And one of the things that I've learned is that whenever God's doing something territorially, he almost always has someone on site that's ready to open the door to him.
Mm-hmm.
I call them gatekeepers. You know, in Chronicles, David ordained 4,000 gatekeepers as king. And we need to understand that anointing a little better. That's another story. But I often come into a place, if it's the first time I'm there, and I'm asking, Lord, connect me up with who you already know or who you got your hand on that's able to open the door to your spirit and what you want to do. And so I expect God to order my steps, and I try to go with my ears and my eyes open, looking for the local that God has his hand on. And they're not always hard to find if you pray that way. So I walked into the hotel, and the lady behind the desk calls out my name. She says, "Are you Mr. Benz?" And I said, "Boy, you're really good at your job," because I hadn't said anything yet. She said, "Well, you're the last one to check in. I just kind of figured that you must be Mr. Benz." So it was just a little bit of an exchange that was odd. It was not a normal way to start a conversation on her end. I was a little bit impressed that she was up to speed on her job and she knew who I was. So I asked her, I said, "You know, do you like look at all the names? How did you know I was the only one left?" And she said, "Well, I was actually here last night when you booked your reservation. I assigned you your room last night. So I was realized that you had not checked in yet, so I was looking for you." So I said, "Well, okay." And then she got this real funny look on her face. And I know if that kind of looked like she's sitting there like she wants to say something else but isn't sure if she should. And I asked her, I said, "You know, I'm here for a real interesting purpose, and if you know something else, please tell me." She goes, "Oh, I'm not sure I should say it." And I said, "No, I want to hear it." So I looked at her and I said, "Look, I'm a spiritual man, and I believe God's doing something with me, and I need to be here, but I don't know why I'm here." So I looked at her and I said, "You work here. You live in this area. Why am I here?" And she said, "Well, I did hear something really strange when I booked your reservation, but I don't have that kind of experience very often, so it's uncomfortable for me to say it." I said, "Well, please tell me just whatever you know. Don't worry about it. I experience this kind of stuff all the time." She said, "Well, I was sitting in the office, and I was booking the reservations, and when your reservation came in over the Internet, I assigned you your room." I said, "Well, that's not unusual. So what did you do? What made that different?" She said, "Well, I heard this voice inside me, and that's never happened to me before." I said, "What did you hear?" She said, "I heard this voice said, 'He's an ambassador. I'm sending him. Give him the presidential suite.'" And she looked at me, she says, "Are you a real ambassador that's kind of incognito or something? Because I looked up your name and you're not an ambassador of the country." I said, I kind of laughed. I said, "I'm not an ambassador of a nation that you understand, but I was sent by the Lord Jesus. He's the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And the word ambassador is one that's sent on an errand. I'm representing him. I am here to represent him." And I said, "He's the one that's important that's coming on your hotel site, not me." And she said, "Well, I gave you the presidential suite, but I was kind of thought it interesting what I heard because that's not normal for me to hear something like that." And so I said, "Do you know Jesus? Do you know the Lord as your Savior?" And she said, "Yeah, I believe in God and I believe in Jesus. I just don't hear like that." So I said, "Well, did you hear anything else?" She said, "Yes, as a matter of fact, there was one other thing. I heard that I needed to give you the presidential suite, that you needed to be here for two nights, not one. So I booked your reservation just like you asked for it, but I've also reserved you for another night. And I did that without pay. I'm applying your payment to both nights. So you're getting the presidential suite for the price of one night, for two nights." And she said, "I heard that I needed to introduce you to the gentleman that is in charge of our museum on the island and a few others that work here at the hotel that have lived here most of their lives." I said, "Okay. That sounds like you heard a word from God. And don't ever be afraid of that. Listen to his voice and let him lead and guide your steps. And thank you very much for telling me." this is going to be fun. We're going to figure out what he wants to do. And I had no idea that it would relate to some of the other things, but I just thought that was so much fun. And it was like, one minute I'm feeling alone, another minute it's like God's already got somebody on site that's hearing him and obeying him. Even though it was her first time to have an experience like that, she was obeying what she heard. That's what's critically important when we're doing spiritual warfare. It's not just to run into the battlefield and try to take down the demons, but it's to hear and obey. So anyway, it was 9 o'clock. She texts me in and she tells me, we'll take care of your bag. We'll have the valet park your car. She said, your room includes supper and breakfast, and the restaurant's only open till 10. So if you want to go right on in there and get you a meal, we'll get your stuff up to your room and you can go up there in a little bit. And then you need to come down sometime before 10 o'clock and have your breakfast. And so I went in the restaurant and had a good meal and went to my room and got some rest. And the next morning I went down for breakfast and a different lady was at the desk, but she had a note for me and said that I had an appointment arranged with the museum director and that he was blocking out most of the day to spend with me. So I had my breakfast and then when I went over to meet with him. Again, I'm just there. I don't know personally yet why I'm there. I'm just hearing and obeying what I do know. But I'm rested and I'm well fed and I've been taken good care of and the presidential suite was fabulous. And it was like, Lord, why did you give me this? I didn't ask for it. I didn't ask for, a special VIP treatment. Why are you doing this? So when I asked the lady at the desk, the one that I had met the night before was not there. So I said, this is a pretty nice room, which you guys put me in. And she looked at me. She goes, no one has stayed in that room since 1948. It's been totally remodeled. You're the first guest that actually has stayed in there since it's remodeled. She said, the last person that stayed there was actual president. And I thought, well, that's interesting. So I'm sitting there just pondering the idea of that, not getting caught up in the luxury of the room, but just thinking, what is it about that room that God was wanting to invade? And thinking it's not about me having a nice king-size bed and some luxury. It's about him coming in and doing something himself. Why did he need the presidential suite? Why did he want to do something in Jekyll Island? And those are the way I'm questioning and praying. So I go meet with the museum gentleman. His name is John. And when I go meet with him, I just introduced myself. I told him a little bit about who I was and what I do. He was not a very spiritual guy, so he respected it, but he just kind of told me right off the bat, I don't really understand prayer and intercession, that kind of stuff. He said, I believe in God, but I'm not very spiritual. And I said, well, that's okay. You're still important. There's something you know that I need to know. And I said, I don't know if you'll understand it, but the King of Kings set this appointment up. There's something you know I need to know. And I'll pray for you, and I'll pray for the business here, and I'll pray for whatever it is that God wants, but just please attend to this as something very, very important, and thank you for your time. So we started talking. He was, of course, started out talking about the financial stuff because this Jekyll Island is where the Federal Reserve banking system was birthed and conceived. And at one time when it was functioning in the 1900s up to the 20s and 30s, some say one-third, some say two-thirds of the world's wealth would vacation on that island. Mm-hmm. It was the highest conglomeration of wealth in a single place very often anywhere in the world back in the turn of the century. So it just seems like a little island that's not anything significant at all now, but it's amazing to see the financial side of the history of that spot. And so I'm sitting there looking at some of the things that he's telling, and just thinking about some of the things he's telling me. We went out, walked around, and he showed me some of the cottages that had been restored, and the club itself, and the rack, the tennis courts, and you know, they had a pier where the boats would come up, and he's just kind of showing me the grounds, and then we go to the museum, and he's talking a lot about the financial stuff and the guys that built it, and each cottage was, you know, marked and named. Some of them had been restored. Some of them didn't exist anymore, but they had like a sign that this is where this one was, and that one was built by J.P. Morgan, that one was Rockefeller's, and, you know, that one was, they had each one of them named. Well, they're all kind of native names, and then they're all, you know, got some kind of plaque on who the financial mogul was that had built them. And they're not really elaborate, luxurious mansions. They're just simple cottages for the most part, which was kind of interesting to know that the richest people in the world built them, and they were very low-key and almost like a, you know, cabin in the woods instead of a luxurious house like you'd expect. And they all had Indian names. So I started asking them about the Indian history of the island, and he lit up. He just was like, that's what he really wanted to talk about, because he loved the Indian history. And so he takes me back to the museum, and he said, we got a lot of stuff on the Indians. He said, this was actually the government main community for a tribe of Indians that don't exist anymore. And that tribe was called the Timucas. And I said, well, that's interesting. My name's Tim. Anyway, I didn't know anything about the Timucas. I'm from Oklahoma. I've learned a lot of Native history, and I have some Native bloodline, but I did not know anything about the Timucas. So I just asked him, please tell me everything that you can tell me about them. There's something about the Natives that I feel like I need to know. So he said, well, the Jekyll Island Club was actually built on top of everything that the Indians had. So they just kind of wiped the village out and built the club on top of it. So wherever the chief's house was, there was a cottage now. Wherever the council house was, there was now the Jekyll Island Hotel. And he said everything that's built and visible today is actually sitting right on top of something that was significant in the Indian village when it existed. So he said the fact that this whole place had to go into ruins and then be rebuilt and become an archaeological state park, he said, it actually helped us identify the Native history because the club itself had almost erased that. And so I said, well, you know, let's look at the museum. I want to see some of the Indian stuff. So we're looking at arrowheads and spear tips and, you know, just artifacts that they had found and pottery shards and things and seashells that they had had. And he showed me all their stuff in the museum. He shows me some fragments of a weapon that was like an unusual bow. And when I say unusual, I mean that it was like a double curved bow. And that was a very unusual shape of the bow for a Native tribe. I had never seen that shape before with an American Indian tribe. And I've seen a lot of bows and arrows. So I asked him, I said, this seems unusual. I've not seen this before. In Oklahoma, every Native tribe, the bows would look like a single bow or just a single curve. I said, this is quite extraordinary, especially as far back as this tribe was. So he said, yeah, we found a lot of weapon-type artifacts that we've not seen with other tribes. And I said, well, how do you know these were Native Americans? Maybe they were from somewhere else. He said, oh, no. They were the Timucas. They're well-established along the Florida and Georgia coast, and he said we got a lot of stuff in three or four states about them, and they were quite prolific at one time. So he said, we know they're Native Americans. I said, well, all right, what else you got? He said, well, we got some skeletons. He said, do you want to see the bones? And I said, well, yeah. You know, that sounds, you don't get to see a skeleton very often. I said, are they where we can actually see them, or are they buried? He said, no, they're visible. So they had a burial site that they had been very respectful for when they built the museum. When they found a burial site, they didn't move the bones. They left them where they were, and they just uncovered them to where they were visible, and then they built the museum on top of them. They did basically the same thing with the museum that the Jekyll Island guys had done with their houses. They put a piece of plexiglass over the burial site so you could see it, but they were still trying to respect where the bones were and not move them. And so I'm looking at four skeletons of the Temuka chiefs. And they knew they were chiefs just from different things that were buried with them. So all of a sudden I look and I realize, man, these guys are really tall. And I commented to the guy that, you know, how tall are these guys? They look unusually large. And he said, yeah, they're all about 8 or 8.5 foot tall. I thought, well, that doesn't seem like a normal Native American, especially the tribes that I'm familiar with. He said all the Temukas were unusually tall, even the women. And he said, we found other skeletons and, you know, parts of bones out in the grounds. And he said, we've got pretty good evidence that nearly all of them were extraordinarily tall. And I said, well, what is, you know, what? How do you explain that in relation to other tribes on the Atlantic coast who were not? He said, I don't know. It is an unusual anomaly. He said, oh, by the way, I've got a painting that you might want to see. It's actually the copy of the original. We've got it under lock and key. But he said, I've got a painting that actually shows the Indians from a group of French colonists that came to the United States before it was the U.S. This was right after Columbus. He said that it was the first colony of French folks that came over to try to establish a colony on the coast. He said they landed in Jekyll Island, and they had some interaction with these Indians, and then they got so appalled by what they saw and witnessed that they fled at night and ended up in San Augustine, Florida, and established that city. So I said, were they the Huguenots who were the French group that established San Augustine? He said, yes. I said, well, I'd like to see that painting then. So he pulled that out. I'm looking at it, and it shows the Indians and all their regalia, and they're dancing around and having some kind of a ceremony, and it's got the fire, and it's got just, it's a typical, either they're having a party or they're having a war scene, and it has some things with the weapons. So I said, gosh, this has got some weapons in it that clearly validates the archaeology that they found. And then I see an altar, and I'm going, I don't know of a Native American tribe anywhere in the country. I know some that had log houses or high places or worshipped, you know, nature in some way, or had totem poles or that kind of stuff, but this one has a stone altar, and it looks a whole lot like the one that I had dealt with in the Middle East. And I'm looking at the picture, and I'm going, is this an altar? Is this stone like something they're sacrificing on? Because this guy's holding babies in his hands in this picture. He said, yeah, they're cutting those babies. They're hacking those babies up in that painting. And so what? When you look at the details, two of the shamans or chiefs are holding a baby up by the ankles, and they're whacking their heads off and spilling the blood on this altar. And I'm like, sir, I don't want to be disrespectful of your training and archaeological understanding and history, but I don't know of any Native tribe that did what I'm seeing here, unless it was an act of war. And this is really, really unusual. And I've seen this type of scene with artifacts over in the Middle East. And I've seen weapons like this over in the Middle East. I said, are you sure this is Native Americans and not some kind of colony that came from over there? And he was convinced they were Native. And I said, well, I'd like to show you some things on a few websites that identify artifacts in the Middle East countries, and especially Egypt and Israel and Syria and Jordan area, and some of those spots where there's some of these ancient groups. And I said, this type of altar, this type of religious ceremony, and some of these weapons, I've seen them before over there. Well, he was quite interested in that because he loves Native American history, but he's starting to question, well, maybe I need to dig into this more. That was his comment. So I said, at that point, then I thought, I believe this is why I'm here. I needed to see this and hear about this. You know, at this point, I'm not that concerned about the financial stuff anymore. I'm wanting to know, where is this altar? And so I asked him, I said, can you take me to this altar? I often pray over these things, and it's very beneficial for the land and for the country and for the people. Can I go to this altar and see it? He said, I can take you to the altar, but you can't see it. I said, why can't I see it? Is it buried? He said, no, it's not buried, but it has a house built on top of it. I said, who would be crazy enough to build their house on top of a blood sacrifice altar? He said, well, Rockefeller was. So,
nice.
You know, I just, like, okay, can we go there? And he said, yeah, it's just a short walk. Come on. And we've actually, you know, had already walked by it. So he said, I've got the keys. He said, normally nobody can go in. The way these things are set up, they're historical homes now. The state of Georgia owns the park. They lease out to another group, the hotel, to run. But the houses are maintained on the National Historical Register, and they're part of the state park. So you can't go in any of them without a guided tour or permission, but you can go look in the windows and walk on the porches and walk all around them. And they're set up inside just like they were when they were actually being used back in the 20s and earlier. So we go over there, and he's got the keys, though. So we go into the house, and he takes me into the parlor. And he says, well, I know you're a praying guy, so you probably would like to have a little time to pray. He said, you're standing right on top of the altar right now. This is the room that is built on top of it. He said, I'm just going to go over here and sit down for a few minutes and read the newspaper, and I'll let you pray and do whatever you need to do.
Now, this parlor, that's where those guys, J.P. Morgan and all those guys, actually conceived of the Federal Reserve, right? Right over that altar.
That's exactly right. It's the room that they were sitting in when they drew up the entire legislation and planned to pass it that became the Federal Reserve Act.
Wow.
So this was the conception of the Federal Reserve banking system on the parlor sitting on top of a blood sacrifice altar.
Where babies were sacrificed.
Yes. And so all of a sudden it's like, wow, no wonder our banking system has so much corruption in it, even when people want to do the right thing, you know?
No kidding.
And so, you know, just being a banker is not an easy job, but it's like, not all of them are bad guys, but it's like, wow. And that was not what our founders set up. That took over. It usurped the authority of the way our founding fathers suggested that we bank as a country. And even the way it was passed had a lot of, you know, things that didn't seem right about it. But the idea that it was conceived like this, I'm going, this is not just a bunch of wealthy guys that got away for a vacation and came up with a profitable business plan. This has got something diabolical, something occultic about it, something evil that's what I've dealt with it.